This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Thank you for tuning again this week to hear this week's podcast, which I think may go down as one of my favorites. This is quite an interesting conversation that I had with young Miss Carissa Hendricks. I had recorded this conversation after having a text from my friend Tim Ellis in Australia saying, you've got to chat with this young lady. She is wonderful and she is creative and has so much to offer. And I said, it sounds great. And I had gotten together with her through Facebook, and we had sent some private messages back and forth in order to set up a time. And so between the Christmas and New Year holiday, we both had a little bit of time to sit down and record this chat via Skype, she in Canada and me here down in Houston, Texas. Anyhow, we had just a delightful conversation, and then I had a chance to meet her later at the Magi Fest when she was just kind of passing through for a couple of days. Actually, she was there for a day or for an evening, and then she decided to stick around a little bit longer. But she was on a lecture tour with John Reed, and as I understand it, that's going to be going on through March, and they have several dates that are booked throughout the country. So nevertheless, she's been traveling around lecturing with John, and this is a lively conversation, wonderful conversation from the standpoint that she is an artist. She's someone who, if you want to really go back into more detail, there was a July 2017 article in Vanish magazine that I would recommend that you go back and listen to read that article. Certainly that Paul Romani does a wonderful job with this free magazine. This is a digital magazine. And she was on the cover of that magazine in July and had stirred up some controversy, I guess, because the caption on the cover said the 15-year overnight sensation. And I believe some people misunderstood that as being a 15-year-old person, which she would have been underage to be posing in such a provocative position. But obviously she has been performing for 15 years, and they consider that as an overnight sensation. So she's been doing that since she was a young age, and so she's into her 20s, and so she's of age, certainly. Nevertheless, she is a wonderful performer, and she is a great artist, has a lot to offer, and her philosophy of life is important to get uncomfortable. In other words, you should move into different areas of things that you haven't tried before. You shouldn't just kind of stay in your own comfort zone, if you will. You should try to get out and to challenge yourself and to stretch your abilities. And and she certainly does that. And she has created a wonderful character called Lucy that she's performed again on the stage there at the Magic Castle. But nevertheless, I'm not going to spoil too much of this. I know that you're going to love this. She has just a lot to share. And there is a lot in this podcast, and it goes just a little bit more than an hour, but I think it's going to be so fascinating. It's going to go by, just going to seem like 10 minutes to you. It's going to be fascinating. So please welcome my guest here this week, Carissa Hendricks, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and today we have someone who I think you guys are going to enjoy this as much as I am. This is going to be a lot of fun because we talk with a lot of magicians all the time, and when people think of magicians, they typically think of a male magician. And today we're speaking with a female magician, and I'm so glad that we are, and I hope that we are going to be having more and more young ladies like you who are going to be showing the good side of magic and getting more feminine magicians involved as well. So I've got with me today Miss Carissa Hendricks. Hello there, Carissa.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm glad that you're here, and I'm glad that you had some moments to chat. It was, we have so much really to talk about. We were just off air before we got on. We were talking about Magic Live and that you had been working with Magic Live, and people may not have seen you there other than kind of being behind the scenes. What were you doing specifically this past year?
The last 3 years, I backstage managed the general sessions. So the first year I worked there, it was me and Paul Draper and Rick Gerber, and the second year was Rick Gerber and me, and that was basically the whole team, and then also audio and visual and stuff, but like we run it. And then this last year was fantastic because we got Chris, I feel horrible for forgetting his last name, but we got a content producer this year. So it was Rick and I, and then we had this wonderful content producer, and then we also had our two full-time hosts, right? We had Jonathan and we had Julie, and it was very different. Yes. I don't know if anybody felt it. Like last year last year to the year before was quite different. So basically my job is everything that happens backstage, all the props coming on and off, making sure that people come on and off when they need to, making sure all the mics are the right mics, and making sure everybody has coffee and that their notes are good. And so basically I'm the only Magic Live rep backstage. I'm the only person from the team that's backstage with everybody for the 8 hours of the general session. So anything that happens is my job. And it's a little stressful, but the truth is that most of my job is just to look someone in the eye and go, "Hey, you're going to be okay." Because people get so stressed out. Like, uh-huh. People who've been performing for years and they're amazing. And you can just see behind their eye this tiny panic attack brewing.
Right.
And all I can think is like, why? But it's because they're about to do something for their peers. So they get nervous in a different way.
Sure.
So that back room is wonderful because I get to see all of these amazing magicians, these heroes of mine. Mm-hmm. And some of them are just like, they're unfazed. But some of them, you see them in these weak moments and it's really kind of cool.
Yeah, I would imagine so. You know, whenever I have seen some guys, particularly like when I've been to the 4F convention, I remember some guys who almost freeze up, it seems like, you know, because they look around them and they don't mind being one-on-one with someone who would they consider their peer. But then when you have this mass of people out there, you know, who have written books and produced DVDs and been on television, done et cetera, you know, that some of these guys really start to freeze up. And I'm thinking, golly, this is one of my heroes, and that he is he's so nervous. And so it makes me feel better to know that, you know, even these guys can be nervous also. So you kind of learn a lot, I think, you know, from when you're backstage like that and talking with those folks.
It's super humbling.
Yeah, I guess that's why, again, that I was going to say people didn't have a chance really to see you, because that you have been backstage as opposed to some of those who are down there who are giving out the registration, you know, the T-shirts and your schedule and registration packets and things like that. So you weren't necessarily as visible being backstage all the time.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, Chris Chelko, that was our content producer.
There you go.
Okay, I can sleep at night now. Sorry, I apologize for screaming that at everybody.
No, that's okay.
So I'm not around much. Although the people who know, because I walk across the stage and I do stuff. And every year I seem to get pulled into some kind of bit. So mm-hmm. The year before, we did this little bit with Bizarro, and Michael and I had this bit where, like, I snuck up behind him and moved something, and he, like, pretended it disappeared, and there was a couple things this year. Last year, I was much more invisible because we did that thing where I set one side of the stage while the other side was still going on. Mm-hmm. So I was very much invisible this year, which I liked a little bit more for the look of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I kind of miss doing the bits with people and, like, and that kind of stuff. But it was fun. And I mean, like, working with Richard Turner and like, being responsible for getting him on and off stage because he's blind was very stressful. Very, very stressful in a way that I was not and nobody gave me any instructions. They were like, oh, and Richard Turner will be here. Okay, great. What do I do? But he's very independent. That's why nobody gave me instructions, because he didn't need anything. But you just feel overly careful, and you're like, oh, I should be doing more. But it's great. It's the greatest job. And I messaged Dan this year, because it's this interesting thing where the registrations go up. And I always have to message Dan and go, hey, do I still have a job? And because he just assumes like I'm part of the team forever.
Right.
But I want to know. I want it in writing, like, hey, you don't have to buy a ticket, because I don't want it to be like, oh, we hired someone else and now you can't go because the tickets are sold out. And this year I messaged him and I went, hey, so I see the registrations are up. I'm still good to go. And he just flat out said, you know, you have a job here until you don't want to have a job here. So you don't need to ask anymore.
That's nice.
Perfect. Good. That's nice.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of other people who are kind of, I would say, backstage. I mean, again, like at registration, or they're helping, you know, corral people, or, you know, working in one area or another. And I know Stan has had a big team, and I was part of that for a few years then as well, because of just that I was part of the staff and also with the magazine. So once the magazine had gone away, then he kind of was saying, okay, well, I'm going to be starting to reduce my staff. So he really doesn't have as large of a staff. But for the most part, it seems like most of them are like you and Kayla Drescher and his daughters and some other people, Bill Cook and some other guys, you know, perhaps who might be more of your age as opposed to people who are more of my age, you know. So he has a young face that is showing to the people who are coming, you know, kind of behind the scenes, who have, and maybe some newer faces that people haven't seen. You know, like
yeah,
you guys.
I don't know if that's the focus. I think Stan's priority is just to have the best team.
Yeah.
And so sometimes the best person for the job is somebody that's a little bit fresher and has a fresh outlook, and sometimes the best person for the job is somebody who's 85. I got given an assistant this year backstage, and he was wonderful, and he was an older gentleman, but he was perfect. And Stan picked him because he was genuinely the best person for the job.
Sure.
It's a big team at Magic Live, but the nice thing that Stan does is he surprisingly gives us in the general sessions quite a bit of organizational autonomy. So he's very much involved in the planning and the setting up, and he's a bit of a micromanager, and he's got his fingers in everything.
Right.
But then when we start, once Sunday morning hits, we're on our own. And I prefer that. That's really nice, because the team is so big that if I felt like I had to also, you know, talk to everyone at registration and know everyone here and know everyone there, I think it would be overwhelming. But because, you know, Chris and Rick and I and Julie and Jonathan, that was the core, right?
Right.
As long as five of us knew what was going on, we were fine. And that was really, really nice this year. So I was super grateful for that.
Well, I really did like the feel of that, certainly with Jonathan and Julie being the co-hosts or MCs each day. So it didn't change from day to day. And you had that same feel kind of welcoming you back each morning or afternoon, mm-hmm. whatever your session was going to be. Well, anyhow, yeah, those people who haven't attended Magic Live, certainly you should do that, because this may or may not necessarily be the last year. I know it's one that he has planned, but he has had planned for a while. I don't know that he's spoken to you. Do you know anything as far as whether he's going to be doing this continued into the years, or
I probably shouldn't say, but I will say I have a strong inkling that we've got at least a few more years of Magic Live ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we also felt that way about the magazine. So I think it's important to remind ourselves that like things change quickly, and Stan is very responsive, and so he, you know, I would think that he's deciding whether he's going to do next year at the convention basically every year. You know, on the last day, I think he goes, okay, let's do it again, you know, because he has a good time. But
right. But
it's wonderful. And I think the team is really solid now. Last year felt really clean. It felt very easy in a way that the years before didn't, the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I think Stan was more relaxed last year. Last year was the most I've ever seen Stan just hang out.
Mm-hmm.
And not be running around. And I think that's a very good sign for Magic Live moving forward.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think, too, that it's going to be going forward, because he doesn't have the magazine to complement the convention, and so he can really stay focused just on one thing as opposed to having his attention diverted between the two. So I think, I think he's going to be going on for some period of time. I don't know it's going to go on forever. He's, will soon be approaching 70, and at some point, I don't think he's the kind of guy who would turn it over to somebody else, and I don't know that anyone can do the job that he does with the team he's put in place. But again, to kind of focus on that for just a moment, one of the first things that he had said at the convention and his opening remarks had to do with women getting involved in magic, which is how that I opened up this and introducing you here at the podcast. And he was saying that magicians should be more welcoming, certainly, and encouraging.
I'm going to simplify it at this convention. I'd like to simplify it for the upcoming year. Let's just find ways to make women, I'm talking to the men now, women comfortable in our community. So men, how do we do this? Simple. Ask. Just ask. There are women in your club, probably. Ask them. There are amazing women here at this convention. Ask them. Women, it's a little trickier. Speak up. Go ahead and speak up when something is uncomfortable. We are on Mars, or we're been on Venus. I can never remember which one we were on. We were on one of them, I know. I just know it was a different language. You know. But I think this. I think together of all of us, just try to move that needle a little tiny bit. Just try to make people a little more comfortable in our community, that we can do great things over the next year and the coming years. And to check on that, next year at Magic Live, I'm going to have a little discussion on this stage with men and women about how it's changed and how we can all say, wow, you've got to be kidding me, and mean it in a totally different way. Thanks. Let's do it.
How did you respond to it? Do you remember the comment? You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do, because he had to walk past me to deliver that speech, and I was in no way prompted. Uh-huh. Like, I handed him the mic, he walked on stage and said those things, then walked backstage and handed me the mic back and just looked at me and went, "What did you think?" And my response was, it was interesting, but I would have loved to have been involved in that. Especially because that was the same month that the Vanish cover had come out, and there was all this controversy about the Vanish cover, which, if you haven't seen it, was an homage to the American Beauty poster. Mm-hmm. So I'm nude except for a couple of cards covering key locations. And it was a photo I took with Amberlynn Walker, who is one of my mentors in magic, who's been working with me for 10 years. And it was this like big symbolic thing, but it also like burned down the magic community for like a week. And I got tons of hate mail. And, you know, it was just this. So it was interesting to be like, okay, well, I feel like I'm sort of in the flow of this conversation right now, and you did this speech, and it felt like it came out of left field. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated the intention of it. I appreciated that Stan was told that there was a problem and wanted to address it and help fix it. My only beef would be that it's Stan's convention. He had every right to give that speech. However, I think it could have been more effectively done if there were women's voices also included in that. Mm-hmm. Because what I get it. It's Stan's convention. He wanted to come out and be like, I'm the boss. Everybody be nice to the ladies. Okay. And then everyone went, okay. But I think it would have been more effective if it could have been like, hey, I didn't know there was a problem, which I really appreciated that was in his speech, that he was like, I didn't even know there was a problem, because I think that that's where a lot of people come from. And so I think that was a crucial part of the speech. But I think it would have been more valuable to say, I didn't know there was a problem, and here are some women who can speak to this, or here are some specific stories, and maybe not identify those women, or just have had women included more in it. But I don't know. Maybe I'm asking too much, and maybe it was a first step, and now we're going to see that part of the speech next year. Maybe it was I don't know. I don't think I know enough about the background to have like a really strong opinion about it. I see that Stan did something that was necessary, though. I think there was a lot of tumultuous sort of feelings. There was a lot of weirdness going on. And I mean, I think I felt it more because of the Vanish cover and because I had just gone to Australia and won the comedy award at the Melbourne Magic Festival. And I just did Winnipeg Fringe as like this really sexy magic show. And I was feeling it because I had put myself in the center of a lot of that chaos.
Right.
But beyond magic, it's also part of the conversation in comedy. It's also part of the conversation in the film community right now for actresses who've been, you know, put in that, you know, Me Too movement, like that.
Right.
Yeah. So I think Stan was very smart to say something, but I think no matter what he said there, somebody would have had an issue with it. He was not going to win completely. Right.
Right.
But I appreciate that he did say something. The issue I had with it was that, like, other than just, like, that there weren't female voices, was that what he said was, like, you know, if you talk to women, ask them about their experience. I don't super want to be asked about my experience at Magic Live. I'm working. And I think a lot of the women there were there to have a good time. And it's one thing if I'm, like, doing an interview and you want to ask me about that experience, that's fine. Or if we're out at the bar and you're interested.
Sure.
But I felt a little bit like it changed the way people sort of responded to me at Magic Live in a way that wasn't entirely positive, because I've spent a long time putting myself in a position of being like one of the guys and just hanging out.
Sure.
And people were a little over careful with me, and I found myself like teasing them and making little jokes to try and beat back some of that tension.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I did talk with a few women after that, Trixie Bond and some others who are female magicians, to kind of get their take on it, and they were saying, I really haven't received that kind of attention from the standpoint of there being any vitriol or, you know, where they kind of kept me out. I've always felt like I've been one of the boys, like you say. So I really didn't get that, at least from the few ladies that I spoke to. But there must have been something, I guess, that had I guess, been the impetus of his comments that he was making. And I wonder, perhaps, if that might have been something that, again, had been triggered by the cover of the magazine, which I want to go to that here now as well, that was on the cover, of July 2017 on Vanish Magazine, which is a great magazine by Paul Romani. And I recommend that if you don't subscribe or download it, you should. It's a free magazine, costs you nothing, so and has tremendous content inside there. And we learn and meet a lot of new people like you. And that's where I had first heard of you, and then I had other people who had said, hey, you need to talk to Krista. She just finished a week at the Magic Castle, and she has an interesting story and a background. I thought, this just sounds great. So, yeah, I wanted to just we hadn't met before, and we didn't get a chance, like you said, at Magic Live to chat. There were so many people there, number one, it's hard to talk with anybody. It have any kind of quality conversation time, you know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But then we didn't get a chance then to talk until now. So as for that, you said that there certainly was some controversy, and I can understand why, because it was a beautifully photographed cover, certainly, and completely different from any cover on any magazine, Magic magazine, I have ever seen, you know. So tell me about some of the comments, I guess, you know, kind of what led up to that. And, you know, if Paul had talked with you and had some trepidation perhaps about whether he was going to publish that or not, or maybe gave you a choice of some other covers, or, you know, tell me about what led up to that.
Well, Paul is amazing. And part of the great thing about Vanish is that because it is an online magazine, we're given a lot of room to run as writers.
Yeah.
So I submitted an article on hypnosis about 4 months before I was offered the cover. And it was really great. And I got lots of cool responses. And you know, when you write for any magic magazine, you don't get a lot of response typically unless you really do something interesting. And
I know.
I got a lot of response on that. People would see me and be like, oh, I read your little pill article. And so I think Paul noticed that and thought, here's this girl who's been in the magic community for a little while and nobody knows who she is because she works behind the scenes. And I'm mostly a corporate entertainer and have been for, you know, 15 years.
Okay.
So people don't know who I am because I'm just working my little corner of the world and I'm doing stuff. This is sort of the first year that I've really been like, all right, I'm going to do magic conventions and the magic castle and craziness.
Right.
And Paul saw that coming and thought, okay, well, let me introduce you to the magic community with this cover and with
good
this
idea.
Feature.
Sure.
And it was a great idea, and he really gave me a lot of creative control. Him and I and I forget what is his name. Starts with an H. The other editor. Anyway, I'm gonna look it up. They all kind of talked to me about like what the angle we wanted to go with and sort of we had to start from how the magic community saw me, and the truth was that the magic community didn't see me. Mm. And so the concept behind the article was this idea of the overnight sensation, because all of a sudden I
the
had 15-year like,
overnight sensation. Yeah,
exactly. Hal is the other editor. Unfortunately, because of the title, the 15-year overnight sensation. I mean, that's a quote. That's a classic quote.
Sure.
20-year overnight sensation, 15-year overnight sensation. But a lot of people read it as the 15-year-old sensation.
Oh,
and that
oh, my,
image.
My. Oh.
You know, So there was some visual tension there with with the 15-year-old, and like, you know, so that was like the initial issue.
That. Yeah.
But I really loved the feature because we did this. So we decided on this top down layout where it looked like you were looking at my workshop. Cause if you know me as an artist, you know that I'm in my workshop. I have a painting station and tools and I build a lot of my own props and I just adore my workshop. And so we tried to lay it all out as if, you know, the article was written all over my workshop. And so the layout was great. And we decided on this timeline so people could see what I had been doing for the last 15 years. And it was really cool. But because we had done this top down layout, Hal and Paul kind of gave me free range with what I wanted for the cover. And they let me pick. I'm a model as well, so I had like a ton of stuff. And Amber and I had done that photo about 2 years ago. And so I offered it as an option, and I didn't even get to offer my other options because as soon as I showed it to them and they saw that it had the same top-down layout as the rest of the layout,
yeah,
and also that it was kind of iconic and very different, they just went, yep. And so not only did we shoot that ourselves, but that was Amber Lynn's concept. We shot it in my house 2 years before the magazine ever came out. And then I designed the cover. Like, I actually edited it and photoshopped it. I did all the layout for the piece. So I think a lot of people thought that I got bullied into it or I got pressured, but we made all those choices. Paul and Hal were basically like, they were just there to say yes and no. And right. You know, I made a lot of the choices. And I loved it. And I mean, that's always kind of been my focus with magic because my background is theater and primarily visual art. I went to art school. So when I create visuals, I don't love that standard magician photo. I wanted to do something more iconic and more interesting.
Right, right.
And I thought we did all that. And then, you know, I send it in, it gets edited, it gets put in the magazine. I fly out to Australia to open this new show. And I'm 3 days into the run of this show, and my phone explodes, just explodes. People, and no one, the crazy thing about the magic community is that no one sent me hate mail directly.
Uh-huh. Oh, it's just somebody because, else just talking about you, and then they send copies of that to
exactly,
you?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. It was all screen captures. Because, yeah, yeah. And I realized that, like, magic is not one community. Magic is 1,000 tiny little sub-communities. And right. Every community had sort of decided as a group how they felt about that cover. So there were some communities that were like, what an amazing thing. You're great. Rah, yeah. Rah, ladies. And yeah. There were some communities that were like, this is so fun and sexy and playful and modern. And it brings magic into the modern age. It's about modernity. And then right. There were the sub-communities that were like, we hate her. What oh, a man. Horrible. She ruined magic. And so the communities, there were some people that crossover between communities, and Anastasia Sin was one of those people, and Amber Lynn was one of those people, and a few other people, and they started screen capturing these messages and sending them to me.
Yeah.
And it just escalated so quickly out of nowhere. Like,
yeah, yeah.
and I just decided, like, I'm not ready to participate in this. And Amber and Anastasia are both incredibly well-spoken, articulate ladies. And then I saw that Kayla Drescher got in on the chat, and Ariane Black did, and all of these women I adore and think are brilliant all just jumped in and were like, you don't get it, you suck. And so I was just like, you know what, there is an army of people I love and respect defending this. I don't need to be part of this conversation just right. yet. And so I gave myself some space. And then at the end of the run in Australia, Nicholas Johnson invited me onto his podcast to talk about it. And I was able to, like, talk through it almost with him and just say, like, I'm not mad at these people. I think that, you know, the anger and is coming from a place of fear, is that people are afraid that this shows that magic sexualizes women. They're afraid that this is a sign that you have to be young and pretty to make it as a woman in this industry. They feel afraid that they're being put in a position where they have to be sexy and they don't get to just do whatever kind of magic they want. This is a fear response. And rather than get mad about it and pretend it's about me, I should recognize that this is about something bigger. And this fear that is coming from them is because they care so much, and I care so much. So we have a common ground to start from.
Right.
And from there, we were able to chat, and we did this big, massive photo shoot thing at Magic Live, which we're going to launch in a couple of months here. And it was all great. It ended up turning out fantastic. And then when I did my run at the Magic Castle, it was really interesting because a lot of the hate had come from the Magic Castle community. And Jack offered me the run in September, and I had been kind of quiet about it until, like, right before I went to the castle, because I didn't know how people would take it, because I knew that like probably half the hate centered around the Magic Castle community. And it was brilliant because I'm in character, and yes. When I'm in character, I am bulletproof. There is nothing you can say to me. There's no look that will hurt me. I am made of steel. You cannot, like, Lucy is so much stronger than I am. She's a bombshell. She's a god, right? Like, I wrote her to not be a magician. I wrote her to be a trickster god. So she is, like, she doesn't care about you. And it was so powerful because I would walk into the castle as me without my hair and makeup done, and I would see people kind of giving me the side eye, and I would be uncomfortable because my instinct would be like, are they looking at me because they're like, oh, that's a girl with no makeup on at the castle? Or are they looking at me because they know who I am and what I did and what is happening? And then I would put my Lucy on, and I would just
transform.
Not give Yeah, yeah. I would just transform. And there was some magic in the fact that not only did I work really hard at the castle to do a good job to impress those people, but also I tried very hard to let Lucy be very authentic with them and be very generous and let them meet her and see why I did that cover, that the fact that like Lucy is sort of a sexy magic character. It was fitting. And it was amazing to watch these people who would walk into the castle with this side eye, walk out loving Lucy, just adoring her and like hugging me and sending me thank you messages and all these things. Hmm. And it was such an interesting experience because I'm like, oh, wow, I earned their respect. But they also have no idea who I am because they only met Lucy. So it's this.
They still don't know you. They still don't know Carissa.
Yeah.
Right.
They still have no idea who I am. And that's totally fine.
Yeah.
But it's like they were mad at Carissa, but now they love Lucy. So Carissa gets a pass.
Right? Okay. That's interesting. I did watch your video from your Facebook page of that performance there as Lucy. And it's a great clip. And I would encourage others to take a look at that, certainly, because you have a great character that you scripted there. And I can see what you're saying is that is different from what your personality is as we're talking over here then, too. So who is the real Carissa? I mean, certainly when you read Vanish Magazine, they kind of go through each year for the last 15 years and what it is that you have done and the different steps you've gone through from art school and everything else. So kind of in your own words, who would you say that you are? That people should recognize or understand better.
I have no idea. I don't know.
Because you're still developing?
well, yeah. And also, I don't know that I know who I am, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's part of what's wonderful about making a character is that you can create a human being to be who is definitive and specific, sure. and all the things you wish you could be. But you know, I think human beings are complex, mm-hmm. and they fight against being simplified, right? They are full of contradictions
and nuances.
Nuances. I mean, am I my practice as an artist? Because I talk a lot about with other magicians about their practice, because that's a thing we talk about at art school that was sort of the center focus of what it was to make art. And I feel like, you know, not to be too pretentious, but I feel like magic is very much art. But magicians, we have been trained to use a different vocabulary. And so, you know, practice in magic is like sitting at your table and working on a sleight. Practice in art is I wake up, I have a cup of coffee, I sit down, I pull out my paints, And I spend 3 hours communing with the gods of comedy or the gods of art or the gods of writing or whatever I need.
Uh-huh.
You know, that idea that, like, it's not about the sleight. The sleight is important, right? Skill is important as an artist. You practice your line work. Of course you do. But the line doesn't matter unless you are drawing something that matters. And so I'm really, I think maybe as a magician, that's what I am. Maybe that's what I am that is different than other magicians, is that I'm not the best magician, and I'm never going to be. I don't have the biggest vocabulary of tricks. I don't have the biggest vocabulary of sleights, but I have hours of performable material because I sit down and I don't just work on drawing the line. I work on drawing the line, and then I spend a lot of time asking myself, what am I going to draw? How am I, what is meaningful? What can I do with magic that is true, that is art? Even if it's art, but it's also like 20 minutes of jokes.
Yeah.
How can I still make that art?
Yeah. Yeah. I can relate to that. And I understand. Actually, I started out in college as an art major.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I have some, things in common then with you from that standpoint, and I love to draw, I love to paint, and was very much involved in that. And as I was in school for the first year and a half, and I was looking around at the other students who were fellow artists who just had this innate ability and this, I don't know, it was something that they had that I didn't feel that I did. Specifically, that when I looked at their pictures versus what I had drawn or what I had painted, it was mine wasn't nearly as good as what theirs was. You know, again, I just think it was some sort of a natural ability that some people have, and I didn't feel that I was one of them. You know, in later years, I've looked back, and I kept many of the things that I had, and I thought, you know what, it's not bad. And not only was it not bad, but it was my style. And I think that's what's important, is I didn't recognize that at the time, is that, yeah, it's different because each of us are different, and we have our own styles. I mean, when you look at cartoons or comic books or something, you know, the graphic design is so different from one artist to another, and I just drew things different from what other people drew, you know, and I had a different perspective. But I kind of discouraged myself, and I thought, okay, well, I'm going to go into journalism. I'll be an art critic, because I still love art. I go to museums when I'm out of town and visit museums to see things all over the world. And so I thought, I'll be an art critic. And then I thought, yeah, because they make a lot of money. I mean, because there are tons of really famous art you know, critics out there, you know, such as, well, and then there's also, and then of course, oh, well, I can't name a one. I don't know.
So yeah, you don't know anybody yet.
Exactly.
It's not a place for fame.
Right. So I decided to go into advertising. I thought, really, that's what I wanted to do, because advertising really tends to bring everything all together, the creative side as well as the marketing side, and using your personality. And in particular, it has advertising has a lot to do with magic and magicians, because you're trying to get people to convince, rather you're trying to convince other people that what you're holding is in this hand, or something that maybe not real is real or whatever. So you're trying to convince people to believe what you are pitching, basically. So advertising and sales in general is very much like magic, I think, if you kind of compare the things. So that was kind of an evolution that I had, trying to find myself, you know, kind of thing. But again, started in art, love art. And so I admire what you do, and you're staying true to what your intent is.
And I think that like what you were saying, I want to go back to what you were saying before about seeing other artists and being like, I'm a piece of garbage. I think that there are a lot of parallels of that in magic. And I am only just in the last, and I'm going to be honest about this, week and a half, starting to unlearn that of, you know, I see other performers and I'm just blown away at the level of just sheer skill. And I know I'm not interested in that. I can juggle. I can do basic acrobatics. I can hula hoop. I spend a lot of time building a skill base, and now I'm much more interested in making work that is meaningful to me. And that doesn't mean that I don't learn sleights. I learn the crap out of sleights because I have the practice of being a circus artist. So when I do learn something, I learn it till it's perfect. But I don't sit down and just work on things that aren't useful to me. And it hurt sometimes to see other artists and be like, wow, Johnny Thompson at the Magic Castle 4 months ago, right after Magic Live, I watched him take a ball out of his hand over and over again, and that's all he was doing, was he was just taking it out of his hand, but it was like the sleight was so perfect.
Yeah.
So perfect. And it made me want to quit. And when I was in Australia and I saw Danny D'Ortiz, sure, I wanted to quit. And when I saw Joshua J, I wanted to quit. And it's the same thing you experience in art school, where you see other people paint and they're painting these hyper surreal, like these hyper realistic images. And you just go, I'm garbage. I'm made of garbage. But then look at what you like. Like most of the artwork I enjoy is very like visual art is very minimalistic, and it doesn't actually require a lot of high level skill. Maybe. I mean, it does. But I love things that are more conceptual. And if that's what I like in my visual art, it also tends to be what I like in my performative art. Mm-hmm, I like things that are more conceptual. And I think it's okay, especially as a magician, to take a step back and go, what am I uniquely qualified to bring to this industry? Rather than sitting down and breaking my knuckles trying to learn a bunch of sleights that I might not ever use, why don't I sit down and go, how do I approach this so that my work is totally unique, so that I can offer something to this community, so that it's better for having had me as part of it?
Yeah, very well said. You know, and there are a lot of things that I have seen also are magicians who have performed something, and I think I cannot do any better than that. I mean, for an example, there was an excellent routine that Eric DeCamps does with Dean Dill's box. And he just has so great presentation. It's like, well, I'm never going to perform whatever I do is less than what his perfect presentation is. And he does a great egg bag with a nice ending. And it's one of those things, again, I do an egg bag, but I'm thinking, well, you know, that's the ultimate, you know. I'm trying to just come to the penultimate, if I can just be almost as good as this one. But there are certain things I think sometimes magicians will see this. And unfortunately, particularly those who are getting involved in magic early on might think, okay, well, that is a great routine, and they recognize it, but then they, quote, steal it, you know, or they, so they become like a clone, and it's not their routine. And so then you never do find or define your character or your personality, because you don't know who you are. Because I'm a little bit of Carissa, I'm a little bit of Johnny Thompson, I'm a little bit of Scott Wells, you know. You take this routine and that routine, and you're nobody, you know. And because you're no longer original, you're an amalgamation of these other people. And so, which is not a bad thing from the standpoint of trying to come up with that amalgamation to create something, but it shouldn't be so separate. It's like, okay, that routine doesn't fit at all with this routine when you're putting an act together, you know, because it doesn't feel right, or it has completely different character. And so, yeah, like with your Lucy character that you created, I mean, it's wonderfully structured and scripted, and you have a nice character that you've developed. And so, yeah, I think that people maybe shouldn't be discouraged from seeing someone or something that is perfect, because you'd be discouraged from ever doing anything again. I could see what you're saying, that eventually you're gonna say, hey, I'm done, you know, I'm gonna unlearn a lot of things. And so when you're unlearning things right now, as you said, over the last week and a half, what are you unlearning? What are you taking out?
I'm unlearning that shame that is associated, like, in magic. I feel a lot, because I'm a very good like fire performer, and I was for years, and I was one of the best in that industry. And then at 24, 25, I took a look at my life, and I realized I was hiding from what I loved. And I kept putting magic in my fire performances, and putting magic in the sideshow tour, and putting magic in everything. And everything I would write would want to be magic for years. And I was just so intimidated by the startup capital you need to be a magician. You need to know everybody and who did what and where it's from, and there's and I love that about our industry. I do. Now that I'm on this side of it, I value and appreciate it. Good. I love that we do that, but it's very intimidating for somebody who's coming from an industry where, like, I'm doing well and I'm well respected and I have a world record in that, and I, you know, produced one of the better fire eating DVDs, and I could just be the best there till I die.
Yeah,
but it's not what I love. And so you know, I've spent the last 5 years going to conventions and trying to learn and just feeling really intimidated. Like, I'm not good enough, because I don't have all the knuckle busting stuff. And in the circus, where I come from, that's what matters most, is that you are high skill. And then on top of that, you create something really interesting and original. But part of why I moved to magic in the first place was because I really enjoyed that it was this venue for originality, for spectacle, that you got to play more. And so I realized, like, the thing I was embarrassed about not being good at was the thing I wasn't interested in my last industry anyway. So so in the last, like, couple of weeks, especially because I feel like now that I have – this is going to sound – I'm being a little bit too honest right now. But now that I have, like, the Vanish cover and the award from Australia and, you know, the reviews from my tour – my show touring at Fringe Festivals and the Castle. And, you know, not just that I did the Castle, but that I think I did a good job, and, you know, people seem to really like it. I feel like now I have enough credibility indicators for myself to convince myself that I can calm down a little bit, and I don't have to tell myself about how much of a piece of garbage I am all the time. You know, I can kind of sit in my success a little bit and enjoy it. That doesn't mean that I can slow down. My practice hasn't changed. I still spend 3 hours a day writing and 3 hours a day practicing and 3 hours a day building stuff. That's still what I do. But I don't – it's not frantic anymore. It's a lot more relaxed. Like, I'm trying to unlearn that shame of not knowing everything in magic. Because so many people I respect and admire seem to know absolutely everything.
Yeah. Well, but that's not something that's happened overnight, though, either. I mean, it's taken a lot of years, and all of us are still learning, even to your dying day, certainly, or at least you should be, whether it's magic, mostly just in life. I mean, never stop learning and creating. It's just like whenever that you would buy a set of lecture notes, a lot of times the lecturer will say, if he's being honest, is that, you know, that was where that trick ended, but now I have some other variations on that that I can show you now that I thought of since that was published. And if I put that into writing then right now, next week or in a month from now, I may have something even different yet, which is the way that I think that it should be, that you continue to work on things and to refine it. You know, I hear so many people who have been around for a number of years have said, well, that's taken 20 years of my life to come up with that little, to turn my hand this way rather than that way, you know, that you just, it suddenly dawns on you after doing it for so long. So it's not something that you should be discouraged about because that you don't know everything. It's a matter of being inquisitive and wanting to go out and to learn and not to unlearn that inquisitiveness. I mean, I guess it's important to continue to stay the course and to read and to talk with other magicians. And talking with other magicians, by the way, that as a young woman and growing up then and, you know, kind of getting into magic, I wouldn't say late in life, I guess actually that the course that you had taken from the standpoint as you had mentioned about the circus and then art school and going into magic and modeling and with other kinds of film, television, etc., that as you got into magic, were you encouraged or discouraged from other magicians?
Well, I mean, my life in magic has sort of, it's been the undercurrent. It's ran under everything. So, you know, when I was seven, I was hiding cards in the back pockets of books at the library where I worked, where I was the volunteer, so that I could do card tricks for people. And no one had ever taught me a card trick. I had seen a couple on TV and they excited me. And so I made them up. And that's at seven. And then when I was 17, I got spotted doing my show at this haunted house and got picked up as a magician's assistant. And then pretty quickly I was assisting for all of the illusionists in the city and the province. And then they gave me, you know, spaces to work on stuff in their act and help them write. And I've, you know, got onto this variety show with James Jordan here in town. And we started doing this, you know, monthly variety show where I did a bunch of magic. And so, you know, I say that my introduction to magic was 4 or 5 years ago. But that's what I mean as like, a professional. I mean, as coming at it and going like, okay, this is how I define myself now. But magic was always a part of my life. And I have never, ever felt excluded from it. I have felt that fear has come from the inside. Because, you know, when I was doing card tricks as a kid, people loved it. Yeah. But nobody bought me a magic set or took me to the magic club. So it felt like, oh, this is cute. You're cute. Do something else. And then, you know, when I was assisting as a magician, nobody said, oh, well, nobody just decided to like go, you should learn some card tricks. You should learn some stuff. But nobody also made me feel excluded. And I think that's the thing is that that's the difference is that if a little boy shows interest in magic, we buy him a kit. If a young man is helping out with a magic show, we assume that they're going to want to learn some magic. If a young woman is, we don't make that same assumption. And that was the only conflict, was that as soon as I expressed to my community here in town that I wanted to do magic, there was absolutely no pushback, zero. Right. There was nothing but support and encouragement. But I had to overcome that fear that comes from the inside. And I think when you're a little girl and you have, you know, the basically young women have pretty much no big figures in magic to look up to yet. And I think that's tough. Like once you're a little girl, part of the magic community, then you can kind of like pull through the history books and you can find special ladies that you could admire.
Right.
But there's no Lady David Copperfield. There's no Lady Chris Angels. There's no like easily accessible pop culture icons that happen to be female magicians. Not yet. Although I think that that's not far away. I feel that undercurrent happening and I know that I'm going to see that in my lifetime. And it's very, very cool. And
yeah,
I mean, I don't know if you saw the letter that London sent to Penn & Teller, that little girl, that 9-year-old girl.
I did not. No.
Okay. So she's a 9-year-old magician and she sent a letter to Penn & Teller and he tweeted it and it was like, ah, it's featured in this month's Genie. And I saw that and saw that she lives in my province. So I messaged the boys and I said, or the boys, the local magicians, and said, hey, can somebody put me in touch with her? I'm going to drive up to Edmonton and give her a bunch of stuff and you know, do like a little coaching session. And then I found out she lives in my city.
And you live in Alberta, Canada.
Yeah, I live in Alberta, Canada. But she doesn't live 3 hours away where I thought she did. She lives 20 minutes from my house.
Wow.
And she's been part of the Junior Magic Club here for 2 years, and nobody had ever thought to put us in touch. And that's the thing. That's the change I want. It's not that I feel like young women are being discouraged. It's that they're not being encouraged. And because
or recognized.
Or recognized. And because there's so few of them, I think that you need to take a step back and ask yourself sometimes, like, hey, does London, would it be valuable to put her in touch with Carissa, the only female magician in Alberta? Because maybe seeing a young woman who is doing magic and who values it would be valuable to a 9-year-old young lady magician.
Sure.
And I've been mentoring her now for a couple of months, and she's been doing a bunch of shows, and she's just killing it. Like, she's got this fantastic dry wit, and she's really, really good. And up in Edmonton, there is, like, 3 hours north of me, there is an escape artist, a lady escape artist. She's, like, the only female escape artistry performer in Canada. And her and I are good friends, and she actually flew out to hang out with me at the Magic Castle. She was sort of my the last couple of days, she was there to, like, hang out and be my right-hand man. She was my entourage. and she doesn't consider herself a magician, even though escape artist is, like, a subset of magic.
Right.
But she came down to Calgary to visit, and we went and saw London perform. And I realized that in that room were all of the female, all of the magic, all of the female magic in Alberta. And, you know, there's a few others. Like, there's Gwen, who's the magic assistant, and there's a few hobbyists, and there's lots of women who do, like, kids magic. But I mean, like, in terms of professional, full-time, serious, you know, adult magicians, they mm-hmm. were all in that room, and one of them was 9. And and it was that thing of, like, this is what we need. This is what we need. We need...
Yeah.
We need for, if you see a young woman magician, if you see a 9-year-old magician, we need to be like, well, how can we encourage that? How can we encourage that? Not a lot more than we would the boys, but just like, what does she not have that all of the boys in this room have? Well, support of somebody that looks like her, that she doesn't have that. So how can we provide that for her? And I think that would be a big difference until eventually we have more ladies in magic, which I think is like 10 years away. I think in 10 years, this is no longer going to be a conversation.
Yeah, I'm hoping you're right, and I can feel it going that direction also. But what you're saying then is that you really never encountered a wall that you had to get over. You felt like that it was welcoming in your particular city where you were.
Yeah.
And that's great. And I think in most cities that the magicians will welcome young members, whether they're boys or girls or men or women. I mean, it could be that at a certain age, I mean, just like there are a lot of older men who get involved in magic because they did magic as a kid and now they're retired or, you know, mm-hmm. trying to join a club or something. You know, I really don't see that in women, you know, coming in at a certain age. You know, it seems like whenever they're younger that they get involved, you know, with that. But one of the things I had heard one of the ladies I spoke to, and I want to say this was during that same Magic Live convention, and the comment was just, oh, I know who it was, Billy Kidd. She was here, and I had a great conversation with her, and one of the suggestions she said was not to be too attentive to young girls whenever they come to your club because they could be frightened off, you know.
Mm.
And at some point, it can be kind of creepy, you know. I mean, you're trying to be nice and welcoming, certainly, but they might girls might feel as if that I'm getting too much undue attention. You know, I want to get that when I'm on stage or when I'm performing, but they don't quite know that. They haven't learned those skills yet, nor interactive how to talk with adults, I guess. And so I think when some adult men, and I'm talking about, you know, those in their 20s and beyond and on up, when they're talking with a girl who is 9, like the girl you're talking about, they might get more undue attention. They said, treat us the same as you would a young boy who would be coming in and joining the magic club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't spend undue attention because we really need to get more girls or more females into magic. And so you really try, you overtry and you kind of chase people away. Does that make sense?
I think it does make sense. I think that the important thing there is that think about who that's coming from. That's Billy. Billy is extremely independent. She's also a street performer. She's really wonderful and also very self-possessed. And that's what mm-hmm. she would want. She would want you to treat her like anybody else.
Exactly.
And that's I think that is a valuable perspective. Billy's perspective is very valuable. What I would want in that environment is to be not just considered one of the boys, but as a young performer, if I was in London's shoes, I would want to be treated like normal and not given too much extra attention,
sure.
but definitely a little extra attention in the areas where there is a deficit. So, for example, if I'm the only girl in the club and I have no female role models, help me find female role models. Help if there's a trick that I can't do because it requires a suit jacket. Encourage me to think around that. So I totally agree with Billy. But I also think there's environments in which we do need to, we can't just pretend that girls aren't girls and that it's not harder, because it is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we have to mitigate some of those problems. I think the truth behind what Billy is saying is ask how they want to be treated or care about it. Yeah. Right. I mean, I'm going to want to be treated differently than maybe Billy would want, just in the same way that you're going to want people to talk to you differently than maybe Penn likes to interact with people. Mm-hmm. Women mm-hmm. are varied creatures. Men are varied creatures. Humans are varied creatures. Just participate. Like the thing with a minority community, which women in magic are a minority community, is that there are some inherent disadvantages. And so if you can try to mitigate some of those disadvantages, that's valuable, but you don't want to do so in a way that isolates that community further. Does that make sense?
It does. Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think the important thing is just to ask. Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
ask.
And to offer your mentorship as you're doing with London as well. And that, they really are coming there out of a sense of inquisitiveness, I guess. They have a lot of questions to ask. They want to learn. And there's really not a school for young magicians. There's not a Hogwarts where people can go to learn magic or whatever, you know. I taught a class in a local college for about 3 years, and I had, I had over 1,000 or 2,000 people over those few years who came through the class. Some were discouraged after the first week or two and realized that, hey, I'm actually going to have to perform something, and I'm going to have to actually learn something, as opposed to him just coming in and tell me how back at that time that David Copperfield made the Statue of Liberty disappear. I mean, they just came in thinking I was going to be exposing secrets, basically, when I told them up front, that's not what this is about. You're going to learn things, and by learning them, that means not just me telling you, but you're going to be reading, here are some books that I recommend, but also that you're going to come back next week with the skills that I've taught you and actually do something in front of the class.
Mm.
And so I was trying to teach people to actually stand in front of a group. And that's one of the biggest fears that people have, is public speaking. And I think you can get over that by actually performing. You know, I mean, it's like anything else. I mean, like speaking or writing or whatever you want to be good at, you need to do it, just as you are with art. I think had I kept at my paintings and my drawing, I believe that I would have been a better artist because I just had that perseverance. I had mm-hmm. a conversation, a podcast with a fraternity brother of mine, Tom Blomquist, when I was working at the Magic Castle a couple of years ago. And he is a writer and has become a very successful television writer. And he's written like The A-Team for Chuck Norris, a TV show here, Walker, Texas Ranger. Those are some of the shows that he wrote and then later produced and directed. But the point is, he said that there were others who I had worked with who were writers. And we were all being discouraged because they would say that the scripts that we were submitting were not acceptable, or they weren't good, or they got sent back, or that they had given us some advice, you need to do this or that. And he said there was one fellow I worked with who was a much better writer than me, but he got so discouraged, he just threw up his hands and quit and went back to, counting bolts or something on a, you know, went to
it's
a manufacturing
heartbreaking.
Job. It is heartbreaking. And he said, the one piece of advice I would give to everybody is perseverance. He said, just keep after it. He said, if that is your passion of something that you're wanting to do, you're going to get good at it eventually or die, you know, but you're not going to die. Don't worry about dying. You're going to receive some discouraging words and remarks and people, just as you did, you know, from people who didn't like the cover, you know, of the magazine, or felt like that you're taking magic in the wrong direction. So anyhow, it's important, I think, that you stay true to your vision and whatever your passion is.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, that inside voice that tells you you should give up because it's not easy. There's this amazing poem by Charles Bukowski. If you can look it up, it's amazing. It's about inspiration. And it talks about how I'll just read you some of it. If it doesn't come bursting out of you in spite of everything, don't do it. Unless it comes unmasked out of you, out of your heart, your mind, your mouth, your gut, don't do it. If you have to sit for hours staring at your computer screen, hunched over your typewriter, searching for words, don't do it. And that poem drives me crazy. And I read it to myself all the time because I feel like that's a poem that was written by my fear. You know, it's my fear says this isn't easy, so it must not be what I'm supposed to do. But it's not supposed to be easy. It, you know, there's a lot of resistance to making work and to doing it. And you know, professionals, the difference between a professional and an amateur is that in my opinion, an amateur waits for inspiration to come to them and they do things when it's easy. But a professional does it every day. You sit down and your practice, my practice involves as often as I can do it, because sometimes I have to do shows and sometimes I've got meetings, 3 hours of writing, 3 hours of building, 3 hours of skill building every single day. And those are all very specific, where I start from, like, you know, sometimes the writing is just ends up being me watching TED Talks about a topic that I'm really inspired by and just taking notes and things that occur to me and trying to turn it into a piece. Right now I'm working on a piece of magic that I don't know if I'll ever finish it, if I'll ever see the light of day, but it's about starvation and it's about how out of all the things that we're trying to overcome as a culture, starvation is the most visceral to me. When I see those images of, like, even dogs that are hungry, or like you see, there was this old commercial they made where they were visually demonstrating that this woman had to choose between food or shelter. And she was opening the top of a can and the top of her house came up and you watch her, like, sadly close the can and push it away. And it killed me. Like, it just affected me. And so I want to do a piece of magic about about the way that starvation feels visceral and how that this is a problem. And I think that most magicians don't start from that place. They don't go, hey, I'm really moved by our relationship to food and starvation in our culture. I'm going to make a piece of work about that. And so right now I'm writing all of the things I think about that. And then I made a list of, like, concepts or, like, ways I could visually demonstrate that. And then I'll figure the magic out later. But I think that a lot of people start from, what trick did I buy at the last convention? Can I throw it in the act? What was the last cool thing I saw on YouTube? Who do I respect and what is the new act they're doing? And it's the only industry like that. Like, painters don't show up and go, what's the new color everybody's using? No, that's not a thing. Like, you know, what's the new type of paint everyone cares about? Who cares what I paint? It only matters what the kind of paint is. You know, I so want to encourage people, one, to recognize that talk, that Charles Bukowski poem, that is a poem written by fear. Fear is important. It's important to recognize that you're scared to start. And it's good because it means you care. You know, when you saw those other artists and you saw that they were better painters than you, the reason it hurt was because you care so much about art. And so you have to be moving towards things that make you uncomfortable, because then when you succeed at them, you will experience an elation that you would otherwise have never had access to. Because the more you push, you see the fear, instead of running from it, you run into it. You get access to a greater feeling of accomplishment and success every single time. And I keep telling people, like, the week I did the castle was the best week of my life. And I'm not trying to, like, I'm not, that's so true. There is nothing that has ever happened to me that has ever come close to performing at the Magic Castle for so many reasons.
Yeah, I was going to say, what kind of reasons? Why?
Well, I mean,
I don't,
like,
want to give you off track over here, but I was going to ask you about that very thing.
What made it so great? First of all, every single day, someone I love, respect, and admire came to see my show.
Yeah.
What? And, you know, working with Pop Hayden and working with Dan Birch and just, like, just the family that the castle is, and people just, like, coming backstage to give me notes and sending notes backstage saying that they were there, or the, you know, I was least excited about the celebrities that were there, but that was also cool. Yeah. But the reason it was the best week of my life was because I had spent the last 2 years telling myself that the castle was 10 years away, that I was going to have to work 10 years to get there. And I created Lucy. This time last year was my first this month last year was my first, like, conceptualization of Lucy as she is now. I premiered her in Australia in July, and then by November I was performing her at the castle. And the only reason that happened, well, one, because of a lot of generous people and a lot of people supporting me and a lot of people, you know, a lot of support of the community and the fact that the community is wonderful. That's a big reason. But internally, the reason that happened was because every time something seemed undoable and terrifying, I would just do that thing.
Just jump into the deep end.
Exactly. So it was like, you know, Tim Ellis was the one that was like, you have to send Jack this act. He's going to want at the castle. And I said, absolutely.
Tim was the one who told me to talk to you.
Yeah, Tim's been very supportive. He's a great wonderful. Guy. I think because I premiered Lucy there, I think he has a sense of ownership, a little bit of ownership over Lucy, and he should, because he's a lot of, you know, I gotta tell you guys, if you ever get a chance to do Melbourne Magic Festival, 100% do it. It is the best thing for magic right now, because it is a fringe festival for just magic shows. They had over 60 magic shows there last year.
Wow.
Everybody sees each other's shows. Everybody provides notes. Incredibly warm, welcoming environment. But also, they have spent 10 years curating an audience that gets it, that gets that magic is a varied and diverse art form. And so you can go there and try things. And it was amazing. It was the perfect birthplace for Lucy. And it turned her into exactly what she needed to be. And Tim was the one that was like, go do the castle. And I said no. And I mean, when I said no to him, I meant no. I meant absolutely not. And as soon as I heard myself say absolutely not, that's a 10 year plan.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do it. And I think it's
important.
The scariest thing.
you have to have a goal. And that's what I tell people constantly, that if you do have a goal like that, oftentimes, as just happened with you then, Carissa, the outcome happens a lot sooner. In other words, if you want to become of your company or vice president or move up to certain positions within the company, then you have to set your sights on this is what I want to do, and for the right reasons. But like in magic, that you want to work here, you want to lecture there, you want to travel, you want to perform for this group or whatever, you think, okay, well, this is going to be something that will take me a while. I have always found that the reality is that it would come faster by having that goal as opposed to not having it. You know, again, 100%. It's, I guess like Carol Lewis had said, you know, in Alice in Wonderland when he was asking, which way should I go? Well, where do you want to go? Well, then I don't know. So any direction is fine. And so, and that's the problem. People wander around because they don't have a direction because they do not have a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a goal and it's achieved within a shorter period because you had that goal. And so then you have to keep setting other goals. I mean, just because now obviously you've had the most fantastic week in your life, there is going to be another week that you're going to say this was as good as or better than. And so, you know, you have to keep searching and looking for whatever that next goal is going to be. You're a young lady and you have a lot ahead of you. And I mean, we're going to be hearing a lot from you, I know, over the next few years.
Well, and the next big scary thing was that, you know, John Reed, I'm sure a lot of people know who John Reed is, based out of New York. He's amazing. You know, he's one of the most, he's incredibly well respected as a lecturer. And he asked if I wanted to come do the next tour with him. So we're doing a lecture tour mid-January to mid-March coming up all throughout the United States. I think we've got 14 cities booked. And when he first offered me that, my instant reaction was no. And so I said yes, because I have to, because that's what I have to do.
Yeah.
And right now, you know, it's funny because like the anxiety I felt before the castle, which seemed overwhelming, like seemed like I was never going to survive it. I feel exactly that way now about the lecture tour. Like I work 4 hours a day on lecture note stuff and trying to come up with new things and trying to make sure it's perfect and it makes sense. And I'm doing like little workshops here in town and it's all the same things I did before the castle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm terrified. I'm just absolutely terrified. But because so many times now, because I've moved towards fear, I'm more comfortable being uncomfortable. And I think that's something that I didn't realize, that if I could offer a suggestion to the new generation, is that you need to practice being out of your element. It's essential because you'll learn. It's sort of like you got to get punched in the face once so that you're not scared to get punched in the face, because it hurts like crazy. But then you're like, oh, that's as bad as it's going to be. Like the fear of the unknown is much scarier. So if you move towards what you're afraid of, and you sit in that discomfort and you just let yourself be uncomfortable and you don't try and self-soothe, you don't have a bubble bath, you don't have a drink, you just be uncomfortable and work through it, then the next time you're uncomfortable, it's easier. And I think a lot of people point out about Lucy the fact that like Lucy's a lot of improv. It's a lot of talking to the audience, it's a lot of riffing on what they say.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying. It's terrifying because there's bits in the show, everything's very specifically written. And I have backup plans for everything. But when I walk up to the front of the stage and I ask him his name and I ask him what he does, I don't know what I'm going to say. And that's terrifying. And it makes me uncomfortable. But the more that happens, the more I practice being uncomfortable that way, one, the better I get at it. And two, the more I'm never not uncomfortable in that moment. I'm always like, okay, I got to make something funny up off the top of my head. Whatever he says, right. I have to have a perfectly written joke in 3 seconds. I'm okay with that uncomfortableness now. I now wear it. It's now a shirt that fits me very well. It mm-hmm. doesn't mean mm-hmm. I'm not uncomfortable. It means I'm just used to it. And right. I think that in our culture, we feel like we have permission to never be uncomfortable. But if you're an artist, that should be a big part of your practice, is moving towards the place of greatest discomfort and just sitting in that space. So I want to see that more from magicians, because I think magic is tough, because it's a really hard thing to fail. Like, when you mess up a magic trick, it sucks. It sucks about as much as dying when you're doing stand-up. You're like, oh, I am garbage and I hate myself. You know, and so I think it's a hard industry to experiment. It's harder to fail in our industry than it is in a lot of other industries. I think it's being an actress, being a model, coming from those, and being a visual artist, it's a lot safer to fail in those environments. Magic, mm-hmm. for me, has been the hardest. Even circus. You drop a club, that sucks, but it doesn't ruin the act. You give away a trick because you knocked something over, it's the end. You're done. That is the worst feeling. That is terrifying. And so I can understand why people go, well, I'm just going to do tried and true classics. I'm just going to do the jokes I know work, because I'm scared of failing. Because I work in an industry where failing is a big deal.
I had a student once, and I encouraged him to perform, and he had practiced well enough, and he was doing a fine job, but he actually dropped a thumb tip. And as soon as he did, he completely lost it. He said, well, I guess you know how that's done. He picked it up, put it in his pocket, and to this day, he has never done another magic trick. He was so upset, discouraged, and felt like a failure. It's like people had no idea what that was to begin with. I mean, there are a lot of ways that could have and should have been handled, and I told him later, but there was nothing I could say or do. He was thinking, okay, well, I've blown it. That's it. I'm done. I'm not, and because he had been one of my students I had taught in that class, and then had joined a magic club and had performed at a haunted house thing, as it happened. But anyhow, when he dropped that, he said, that's it. So you shouldn't be discouraged.
You shouldn't be discouraged. And there's
didn't die.
No, exactly.
What's going to happen?
And sometimes a failure is a success. There is, in my opinion, there is no greater example than failing gracefully than David Williamson doing the Murray thing. If anybody has not seen that video, it's on Magic Archives, and look it up. David Williamson brings a kid up on stage years ago, and he's going to do a card trick with him, and this kid spoils the card trick. And the way David handles it is blissful. It is perfect. He feels that the audience is enjoying this kid ruining him. And so David just lets them in on the experience that he's having. And he just sits in that space, because David Williamson is a god and he's very comfortable being uncomfortable. And I watched that video, and I'm going to show it in my lecture, of course. But so, because it's a perfect example. It's a perfect example of, like, you know why this is masterful? Because David Williamson is comfortable being uncomfortable. He is on national TV, and this kid is breaking his gimmick, and he is making it work. He's making it a hilarious bit, because he's a god, and he wasn't born that way. That's something he learned, right? I think the other problem with magic, with entertainment specifically, is we have this, there's this have it or you don't fallacy. And that blows my mind. That blows my mind, that it's like, oh, you know, she's got the wow factor. Okay, let me tell you. I've been doing entertainment 15 years. I have footage of my first year, 3 years, that I will show nobody. Because if I saw that person performing, if I saw the act, if I saw myself now performing that act then, I would be encouraged to tell myself to quit. Because it was that bad. It was so bad. It was unfunny. It was clunky. And I see acts like that now in magic, and they're painful to watch. And I'm like, I can't believe I put people through that. But I had to go through that to get to where I am now.
I think we all have those secret videos like that.
Yeah,
exactly. Something too. I know what you mean.
So I think the people who are like, oh, I guess I just don't have it. Yeah. Then go get it. Just go get it then.
Well, listen, as we start to wrap up, you've been giving us just a lot of great advice and everything. And so I really would like to have you give us kind of a closing piece of advice, because, of course, my podcast is called The Magic Word. And so what would it be that would be, you'd say, your magic word or phrase? What is it that you live by that's most important when you wake up in the morning? I mean, you know, what's your phrase?
I think definitely moving towards discomfort. Asking, okay. Being honest with myself, knowing myself well enough to say, what is making me uncomfortable today? And trying to find a way that I can move through it and understand mm-hmm. it rather than run and mm-hmm. hide from it and seek comfort and try and, I think being comfortable is the enemy for artists. Be uncomfortable. Do what makes you uncomfortable.
I like that. Yeah, be uncomfortable. Yeah, I like it. Well, great. Krista, thank you so very much. I appreciate you being my guest here today, and I'm glad we had an opportunity to talk here as well about some important things, and hopefully this might be encouraging that some, not just young girls, but maybe some young boys might be listening and be encouraged then as well, because I think the advice that you've been giving freely here is something that can be applied regardless of gender. So I thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Great. Okay, and so until next time, that was Krista Hendricks, and this is Scotty out.
Wow, was that fantastic or what? I told you that was going to be good. And also, I want to encourage you guys to go to themagicwordpodcast.com, where you will see a video there of a couple of things. One is of her performance on stage at the Palace there at the Magic Castle, being introduced by Pop Hayden. And it is fantastic. I think you'll enjoy that. About a little 9 or 10 minute clip. Also, there is a short video there that is the one that she refers to with David Williamson and the young man Murray. And so it shows that from the English television, then also kind of up to date whenever that Murray comes and helps out David again on stage about 10 years later. Anyhow, go to the podcast and you'll hear that. Thank you very much, Krista. I appreciate the time that you spent and the thoughts you shared, and a lot of insight and some personal information that you had given us, I guess, from just not just your own experiences, but the journey that you've been traveling. And you have a long road in front of you that is going to be full of, I'm sure, lots of successes. And I certainly want to wish you every success, that you deserve the best. And so I hope that you guys out there who have been listening to this, and I say you guys also, that you will be welcoming the ladies into your magic clubs, and also as being as encouraging as you can. And for ladies who are listening, as Krista said, just ask. And I'm sure that you'll be getting a lot of good suggestions from other guys too. And I've got to think in the next 10 to 15, 20 years maybe, that we will see this integration of both men and women, so that we'll be seeing a lot more people, hopefully like Krista, with her blazing the trail, her and so many others. But nevertheless, I think that this has been wonderful. I thank you guys very much. And I want to also thank the people who sponsor this podcast, and those will be the Friends of the Magic Word. And you could become a friend of the Magic Word also and receive some kind of cool perks along the way as well. Because if you pledge just a nominal amount, no more than hardly a cup of coffee a month, that you are going to be able to get some pretty cool perks from going to patreon.com. It's patreon.com/themagicword. Podcast, and that you can find out more information if you go to the website here as well. So again, I want to thank the Friends of the Magic Word, whose financial support helps make this possible, which allows us also from week to week and from time to time to have some contests as well, which we just had recently given out some promotional decks of cards that were from Richard Turner's movie on Delt, and that worked out great. And I had a couple of extra decks of cards I was able to give out, so who knows. I just had Gregory Wilson here, and I'm going to release that podcast in some upcoming weeks, kind of an update on the last one we did together, which was back in, 2015, I guess. And so that was something that was kind of controversial. And so it kind of gives an update briefly, as well as how he's doing health-wise, which, let me just tell you, he's doing well. But my point, I guess, in that is that we're going to be having something we can give away that's a nice little freebie that he has offered, which is a peek pack. So we're going to be giving out one of those then as well. And by the way, a couple of weeks ago was the convention in Blackpool, the world's largest magic convention, and my friend Martin Cox was nice enough to offer to send in his review, and it was really just kind of an opportunity for him to record some chats with friends, and I hope that you enjoyed that. But one of the things that I saw was recently posted on Facebook and also on the Genie Forum and elsewhere was the surprise that Rachel Colombini is alive. And I'm glad to hear that. Certainly, that makes me smile because there was some, I guess, unrefutable testimony by some people who had said, yeah, that she had passed away last year and there was no one coming forward to give any evidence or say that they had seen her or she's been around. People have been trying to look for her and couldn't find her. So she was, I guess, just a missing person. But she showed up at Blackpool and was seen walking about and talking with different people. I saw a picture with Paul Gordon and Richard Kaufman and others, I guess, had seen her and whatnot. So nevertheless, I'm so very happy and thankful that to report that Rachel Colombini is alive and well. And so, to paraphrase what Mark Twain had said, that the rumors about my death were greatly exaggerated. So I'm glad that she's here. I think this now is a good time to wrap up. And so until next week, stay well, get booked, and do what makes you feel uncomfortable. This is Scotty out.